So I say in the poem, 'tis many an age of darkness since the days my Lord did pass. The last century, we may say, with its two catastrophic world wars, could be regarded as an age of darkness. Despite all our vastly improved technology and our higher standard of living, higher at least for a very large proportion of the inhabitants of the earth. Notice also in these lines the change from the rather anonymous personal pronoun of verse 1 to the more intimate and familiar my Lord. But the Buddha, the Lord, did leave footprints. And we can still see something of those footprints even in this present age of darkness. And those footprints are to be found in his teachings. In his teachings as recorded in the Buddhist scriptures. The well-known text, the Dhammapada, could in fact be translated as footprints of the Dharma. Pada means a footprint. That is one of its meanings. Then again, this verse, verse 3, describes the Buddha's footprints as dewy. Now, why dewy? They're dewy because they are fresh, because they're alive. The Dharma is fresh, is alive. Reading the Dhammapada, for instance, you feel as though those verses were spoken only yesterday, not 2,500 years ago. They're so fresh, so appropriate, so relevant. I became especially aware of this the year before last when I was staying for a month at Guhyaloka and completing my own translation of the Dhammapada, which will be launched incidentally on FWO Day. I was quite immersed in the Dhammapada, you know, for all those weeks. And I realized again and again with almost every verse how fresh, how appropriate, how relevant it was. And this is why, or one of the reasons why, the Dhamma is termed akaliko, timeless, is always appropriate, always relevant to our human condition. And perhaps one might say that when I say that the Buddha's footprints, those Dharma footprints, are dewy, it's just a more poetic way of saying that they are timeless, that the Buddha's teaching is timeless. And then again, this third verse describes the Buddha's footprints as being like pearls. A little extravagant, perhaps, but you know, poetry is like that. They're like pearls because they're precious, and the Dharma is precious. The three jewels are precious. That's why they're called jewels in the first place. They're precious because they give meaning to our lives. Because they are what, as Buddhists, we most highly value in the world. They are what, ultimately, we live for. So, the Buddha's footprints are gleaming. They're footprints of delight. They are dewy footprints. They're like pearls. In other words, they are attractive. The footprints, the Buddha's footprints, the footprints of delight are attractive. In fact, they are supremely attractive. The Dharma is supremely attractive, and the Buddha is supremely attractive. This reminds me of a passage in the Surangama Sutra, In this passage, the Buddha asks Ananda what it was that had led him to follow the Buddhist way of life, giving up all worldly pleasures. And Ananda replies, in effect, it's a rather long reply, that he had been impressed by the beauty of the Buddha, as expressed by his 32 marks. Now, we don't usually think in terms of the beauty of the Buddha, we're more inclined to think in terms of the truth of his teaching. We might think perhaps that a Buddha image is beautiful, but when we think of the Buddha himself, Shakyamuni, it's not usually of his beauty that we think, despite the presence in the Buddhist scriptures of quite a number of passages which refer to it. But Ananda, in this sutra, when asked what it was that had led him to follow the Buddhist way of life, giving up all worldly pleasures, replied in effect that he'd been impressed by the beauty of the Buddha as expressed by his 32 marks. And Ananda goes on to say, "These 32 marks appeared to me so fine, as tender and brilliant, and transparent as crystal." In other words, Ananda was attracted by the Buddha, attracted by the Dharma, rather than repelled and disgusted by the world. And I think I may say that this was very much my own approach. And I think that this poem of mine, Sripada, gives expression just to that kind of approach. That is to say, the approach that consists in being attracted by the Dharma, attracted by the Buddha, rather than repelled and disgusted by the world. Of course, the two are not mutually exclusive. More often than not, it's a question of relative proportion between the two. But let us get back to verse 3. The Buddha, Shakyamuni, has left his footprints. He has left his footprints in the Dharma, but those footprints have been overgrown. They've been obscured. They've been overgrown by weeds and obscured by thorns. So what are the weeds? The weeds, we may say, are all the customs, practices and beliefs that in many parts of the Buddhist world have grown up around the Dharma, but which have no essential connection with it. In this verse, I describe the weeds as rank. Rank means primarily too luxuriant. There's perhaps no harm in having a few weeds. We mustn't be too strict. We mustn't be too rigid, of course. Eh? This is something one sometimes hears nowadays. Mustn't be too rigid. Eh? We must just allow just a few little weeds. Eh? So long as they don't get too much in the way of the real flowers. They shouldn't be allowed to overgrow the flowers. And they certainly shouldn't be allowed to overgrow the overgrow the Buddha's footprints. But what about the thorns? Well, the thorns are all those elements, historical and otherwise, that oppose the Dharma and are hostile to the Dharma. The extreme form of that opposition, the sharpest thorn, is persecution, such as the persecution of Buddhism by the Muslim invaders in northern India in the 12th and 13th centuries. And we mustn't forget the destruction of Buddhism in China, Tibet, and Cambodia in their own day. Even today, in today's paper, I read a rather sad little paragraph to the effect that in Afghanistan, the government, I don't like to say Muslim government, but the government had given orders for the destruction of all images, which of course meant predominantly all Buddhist images, of which Afghanistan has quite a number in its museums and in private collections. So it wasn't human beings being attacked, huh? But it was, one might say, only images, images of stone and wood and clay. But the danger is once you start destroying images, you may be tempted to destroy human beings, as in fact has happened in the other countries which I've mentioned, China, Tibet and Cambodia, in our own day. But something we must also bear in mind, the weeds and the thorns that I mentioned in the poem also grow in our own hearts. There, in our hearts, the weeds are the different forms of craving, and the thorns are the different forms of hatred and aversion. And the soil from which they grow is the soil of ignorance. But there is another but. I've spoken of the Buddha's footprints as being found in poetry, in art, even though comparatively faintly. I've spoken of those footprints as being found in the Buddhist scriptures. But one could also say, though the poem itself doesn't say this, that those footprints are found in our own hearts. That rather well-known Chinese Buddhist text, The Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana, speaks of the enlightened mind leaving a trace of itself, a subtle trace of itself, which is sometimes compared even with a perfume, in the unenlightened mind. Speaks of the enlightened mind leaving an imprint, a footprint of itself even, in the unenlightened mind. So our task is to clear away the weeds of craving and the thorns of hatred, to uproot them even. We clear them away by means of shamatha, and we uproot them by means of vipassana, by means of prajna. And having cleared them away, having uprooted them, we can see the footprints clearly and can begin really to follow them. So let me just remind you of that third verse. 'Tis many an age of darkness since the days my Lord did pass, leaving his dewy footprints like pearls upon the grass. And rank weeds have o'ergrown them, and thorns obscured, alas.